Do summer projects your way with Memorial Day savings from The Home Depot. With free delivery on over 2 million items, you can make the most of summer grilling and dig into gardening. Plus, get same-day delivery on thousands of products like power tools and storage to tackle any last-minute garage project. Summer your way with Memorial Day savings from The Home Depot. How doers get more done. Order select and stock items by 4 p.m. subject to availability.
Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math, see how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. 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 Hey, James here. I am so excited. 5 years ago, I started this podcast, and even before I released episode one of this podcast, I interviewed one of the smartest people on the planet, I think, one of my favorite authors, Robert Greene. He wrote The 48 Laws of Power. He wrote Mastery. He wrote so many great books. I highly recommend all of his books. Listen to my podcast with him from 2014. We're re-releasing the very first podcast I did with him, and soon we'll have another podcast with him, hopefully. So, just such a genius. I'm excited to re-release his podcast from 5 years ago. It still holds up today. One thing I will say, he told me in this podcast, and there's just so many things in the podcast that were just unique and special to the podcast, but he said, everybody has a different process and a different journey. Some people come to me and say, I have no idea what my passion is. And then he described how you start developing your passion. You'll hear that in this podcast. But basically, for the next 370 podcasts with such amazing, excellent peak performers in from every industry, I dive down on these questions that Robert Greene and I spoke about in this very first podcast. So enjoy listening to this re-release and let me know what you think on Twitter.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network.
This is James Altucher, and I'm here with one of my all-time favorite authors, Robert Greene, the author of not only Mastery, but the 48 Laws of Power, The Art of Seduction, and several other books, publications, everything. Robert, you're like one of the smartest people I've ever spoken to. When you read your books, there are so many examples and so much research. I'm intimidated by the number of, there must be like 500 biographies in all of your books.
Generally, I read about 200 or 300 books to make one book. I've read probably over thousands of biographies.
What was like the last biography you've read, just so I know what to read tomorrow?
I don't know. I'm preparing for my next book. I actually just read Phil Jackson's new book called 11 Rings. So that might be the last biography I've read.
What's the next book about? And then I want to actually start talking about your last book, which is called Mastery. But what's your next book about?
Well, in Mastery, I have a chapter on what I call social intelligence, chapter 4. And I'm basically expanding that into an entire book. And I'm going to give you sort of the what I call the laws of human nature. These go back thousands of years. It's sort of looking at us humans as if we're sort of animals that behave according to particular patterns of behavior. And I'm going to give you kind of a code book so that you can understand the weird behavior of the people that you deal with. That's sort of the general idea.
Well, I want to dive into that a little bit more because I sort of feel that's a prevailing theme of all of your books, which is social intelligence. But you mentioned specifically code book. What's an example code here that you're gonna dive into?
Well, you know, sometimes let's say you're trying to persuade somebody to fund your project, and they seem interested, and then like 2 weeks later, they're not suddenly interested. And you wonder what's going on, and you assume that they lost interest, they're not a good person, something is wrong, or they're just an ass, if I can say that here. And, you know, you go through these kind of emotional reactions, and I'm going to show you that, in fact, probably what's happening is, first of all, people are very flighty. We all experience a moment of enthusiasm, and then 10 minutes later, we don't feel that same way. But more generally, what happens is you've not been getting at their self-interest. You're not appealing to something. They no longer see what's in it for them. They were initially excited, but they aren't. So I'm going to show you, like, dependent on what it is that you're reading from them, not just their coolness, but other signs, what is happening so that you can now plan your next attack and maybe include something that will sort of perk up their interest more because they'll see that they're going to get something out of it. It's that kind of thing. I could give you 100 more examples, but I haven't written the book yet, so it's all in my head.
You know, it reminds me a little of Robert Cialdini's book on influence and how he basically looks at evolutionary techniques and how those are used to influence people.
I read that book, I think, years ago for Seduction. It's an excellent book, and that, I think I used it a bit in Seduction, definitely, though.
Well, again, it reminds me also of, you know, not only in Seduction, but 48 Laws of Power, those two books in particular, but also in Mastery, how a lot of what you talk about in Mastery is social intelligence, is how we communicate ideas and influence other people. What's the role of that in general in Mastery? Let's say percentage-wise, if you were to break out all the components of mastering a topic.
I don't know. It's more like 20-25% of the game. So let's say that you're somebody who's really brilliant. You're like an Einstein. You're a tech genius or a business genius, but you've got really bad people skills. You're kind of pushy. You don't listen. Oh, you know, I could go on and on.
Thanks for describing me, by the way.
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't know you, so I didn't mean it personally.
No, I'm just kidding.
You're negating all of your talent. So all of that, you know, going to Princeton and getting your degree and all that hard work is completely neutralized by your horrific people skills. And so when I wrote the book, I believe that people nowadays who have real skill, who've mastered a craft of any kind, are going to be running the world in the future. But it's not just about being a great nerd. We're a social animal. Everything you do involves other people. You're always continually having to sell your ideas. And if you're terrible at it, you're just going to have a life of misery. And in my books, I have examples of people who were highly talented and who were miserable because they couldn't deal with people, like Nikola Tesla in the 48 Laws of Power, one of the greatest geniuses that ever lived. but he was just awful with people. And then I have in my new book this doctor, Dr. Semmelweis in the 19th century, who could have been greater than Louis Pasteur, but he offended everybody that he came in contact with. So, you know, it's not everything. It's not all about being political and being a bullshit artist and knowing how to charm people. That has its limitations, too. But depending on what field you are in, you have to have some degree of awareness of people, how they're thinking, how to get inside their minds and imagine what their perspective is. So it's a critical part. And one other thing I mentioned, like, you asked me, like, a code book type thing. You know, there'll be a typical scenario where you just entered a workplace or some new environment, and suddenly somebody is super friendly to you, and it just sort of takes you off guard, and you're kind of charmed and seduced by them. It doesn't have to be a sexual thing. It's just a colleague or a friend. And really what's happening probably is they have a degree of envy of you. They're setting you up for some kind of negative action because people generally are a little wary when they first meet each other. So somebody who's super overly friendly on a first encounter is a sign of something wrong. So these are the kinds of things that I'm going to help you decipher.
That's very interesting. It reminds me a little in your seduction book of the technique where you build someone up when you meet them, so that gives you ammunition to take them down later and have them drawn towards you once you take them down.
Yes, it's a particularly nasty seduction technique. It's like I call it, it's creating a wound in the other person. So you're sort of making it, doing a hot and cold thing where you get them a little bit under your influence, and then you pull back or you say something a little bit biting, but you follow it up with being kind of warm and friendly. It really puts people off balance. Very powerful seductive technique.
I want to circle back to that, but first I want to talk about Mastery of It, which is just a brilliant book. I highly recommend it for everybody. And let's get to specifics. Like, the book has so many extensive examples, and you don't really say, here's how to master something A, B, and C. I mean, you provide lots of A, B, and C's all over the book, which is I think great. But you talk about apprenticeship. You talk about, the various ways then you break away from apprenticeship to form your own creativity. Maybe describe a little bit, if you were going to give someone the 5-minute summary of how to master a topic, what would be the most important factors to look at?
Well, the most important factor is chapter one in the book, and you're never going to master something unless you understand this. The brain is designed to learn. We learn much better when we're emotionally engaged, when we want to learn, when we're motivated, when we feel the need to learn. I compare it to, let's say you want to learn, you have to learn French, and if it's like in the university and it's something you have to study, in 1 year you're not going to learn very much. But if you're in France and your girlfriend is French and you need to get a job and you need to speak French, because you're there and you're motivated, you're going to learn like 20 times faster. That's just how the brain works.
What's happening there, though, is that first you find the girl rather than first you say to yourself, I want to get good at French.
Yeah, that could be. But the point that I'm making is that when you're motivated to learn something, you have to learn it. You're going to learn much faster. So you're in France and you met this great girl, but she speaks no English, and you've got to be able to learn French in order to communicate and seduce her. You're so highly motivated that you're going to learn, I said 10 times, 20, 50 times faster than the university student back in New York or wherever you're studying. So the thing is, a lot of people go wrong. They choose a career because it's about money. I have nothing against money. We all have to make a living. But let's say you go into law because that's what your parents are pushing you into and other people, and it seems lucrative, but you yourself aren't personally excited by it. You're going to start tuning out. You're not going to learn very fast. After 10 years, you're going to burn out. You're never going to become a master because it takes 10,000 hours. You've probably all heard about that 10,000 hours. It's a brilliant study. It's just a number, but let's say it is pretty real. It could be 9,000, 11,000. You're never going to have the patience. You're never going to be able to put in the 10 years or more studying something unless you really are excited about it, unless there's some kind of personal commitment to it. So it's by far the most important thing. It's that choice of the career. It doesn't mean you have to know exactly what you want to be when you're 21 years old and then go pursue it. It's going to be a process that might take you 5, 10 years to figure out exactly what that is. For me, as a writer, it took me 15 years to find out I should be writing books like the kind that I write. It's going to take time. But if you don't make that first step, if you go into the wrong field, you're never going to become a master. You're never going to last long enough. So that's like... That's the first thing.
And I think a big question that many people have is, how do I find the thing that I'm passionate about? Now, you mentioned 5 to 6 years or 15 years in your case in terms of wanting to be a writer. But what is that process by which someone finds what they're motivated enough to be a master about?
Well, everybody has a different process, a different journey. Some people know pretty clearly what it was when they were young. I met a woman who interviewed me. She knew that she wanted to be a writer when she was a young girl, and then she got into law, and it was a dead end, and she hated it, and she finally figured it out that she had to go back at the age of 31 to what she really loved. So there are going to be people like that. But there are others, and they come to me, and they say, I have no idea what my passion is. I have no idea what I really love. And that's troubling, because that means you're not listening to yourself. You're not aware of your own likes and dislikes. You've been paying too much attention to what other people are saying. So you have to go through a process now of kind of looking at yourself. I've worked as a consultant. I've dealt with people, many people, who say that to me. They say, I'm 35, I'm 40. I don't know what it is that I was meant to do. I really have no idea. Okay, let's go back and let's look at your childhood. Let's look at the things that excited you. Let's look at maybe where you went wrong. Let's look at the things that you hate. If you hate working for a large company, if you hate politicking, you probably meant to be an entrepreneur, to be working for yourself on some level. Let's look at the things that when you open the newspaper or go online, these subjects really excite you, make you kind of like a child again, where you want to learn about it. And slowly through, could take a couple months, could take a year, I don't know, depends on the person, you're reconnecting to what I call a voice inside of you that you had when you were a kid that drew you to certain activities and you've lost touch with. I could go on for 4 hours about the process that I've dealt with consulting, but it's basically not going to be overnight. You're not going to wake up and go, shit, I should have been a doctor and I went into the... No, it doesn't like that. It takes time, but it is so worth it.
So after that first realization that, okay, I'm motivated to be a writer, or I'm motivated to discover, you know, more uses of electricity, or to be an internet entrepreneur, or whatever it is, what would you say is the next step?
Well, you know, first of all, if you're 22 and you're about to enter your career world, it's not going to be like, it won't be like, I know this is exactly where I have to head. It's usually a matter of, I like this field, the sciences, or I like sports or whatever. A general category of things that you're going to pursue. For me, it was writing. And so when I was 21, I decided I'd go into journalism as a way to make a living and train myself as a writer. So you're going to make a choice of something to start with that is somewhat related to that field that you love. And it can be kind of general. It could just be the tech world, or it could be a certain kind of business. It doesn't have to be that specific. But you've got to make the right choice. And once you get in there, I'm telling you that you want to think of your 20s as your apprenticeship. Now, we don't use that word anymore, and it's a shame that we don't. We all go through usually the school system, the education system, where we're all kind of guided and there are teachers there to help us. Now there's nobody there to do anything for you. Maybe your parents, but really nobody's there to guide you in this new part of your life. So you're creating your own apprenticeship. And that apprenticeship means you're going to learn skills. It's not about making money. If you are 22 and you're obsessed with making money, you're never going to really make a lot of money. It's kind of a perverse law of human nature that I'm going to discuss. The people who end up making the most amount of money are usually motivated by something else. And the classic example is Steve Jobs, somebody who from very early on was clearly not very interested in money, and look where he ended up. So you're choosing something that appeals to you, and then now you're open. You're on I call it a journey, and you're going to discover, I like what I'm doing here, but there's something better for me. It's not exactly right. I knew that journalism after 3 years wasn't really right for me. So I went into a different kind of writing. Well, you'll figure, all right, I'll go into a different line of work, a different business, still related. And as you do this, you're going to be accumulating skills, experiences. You're going to be observing people. You're going to get political, social skills. And by the time you're 31, you're going to own the world. You're going to have a lot of experience, and then you'll be able to figure out how to combine everything that you've learned into something great, something that really appeals to you. And I give examples in the book. You know, there's a guy, I interviewed contemporary masters. One of them is Paul Graham, who started a company called Y Combinator, which is like a entrepreneur system for tech people in Silicon Valley. It's worth billions of dollars. And he is the same thing. He didn't realize until he was 31, I think 30, what it was that he was meant to do. But in his 20s, he did all of these amazing experiences that served as the foundation for what ended up being this great tech business that he created for Netscape back in the 90s. So be prepared not to necessarily strike gold when you're 25 or 26. It's going to take some time. But if you think of it as your own education that you yourself are in charge of, you're going to be a lot better off than people who just wander around and just choose any career.
Robert, I think this is a really important message now, even from an economics point of view, just because what we're seeing is kind of the disintegration of the middle class. And the middle class was formed by the conformity of the traditional school system, the conformity of traditional corporatism, where everybody feels that they're safe in their cubicle and they could rise up and get promotions and so on. People now have to essentially, whether it's become masters or become close to masters, they have to take charge of their economic lives, which means they have to do something they're motivated by and they're interested in. Even if they don't put in their 10,000 hours, they kind of have to take control of their own lives. And that's why I think this message has become critically important in today's society.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I can look at my father. He worked at the same company for 40 years, and they were loyal to him, and he was loyal to them. And it's not that long ago that world existed, that people would work at one place and things were sort of taken care of. But that's just been blown away, obliterated, probably by the internet, by other things going on. It's you might as well be the era of the dinosaur. Right. And you cannot rely on, you know, that company you're working for now, they'll probably downsize you the first opportunity they can, or as soon as you reach a certain age, they'll replace you with somebody who's cheaper. That's just the nature of it. I'm not saying it's good. I wish it weren't that way, but my books are about realists or being a realistic, and that's just the nature of it. So, yeah, you got to take control of your own life and craft an apprenticeship. Now, you mentioned the 10,000 hour. It doesn't mean, I want to clear up a misconception here. It doesn't mean that you are learning, you're playing chess for 10,000 hours and then you become a master or medicine or whatever. Those 10,000 hours could come from different things you have done in your life. So, for instance, this woman that I mentioned, who spent her 20s in law and realized it was the wrong thing, she decided when it was finished that what you would do is become a writer, but become a writer about legal issues, which was a very brilliant move on her part. So now all of that legal experience added up to 3,000-4,000 hours already of writing, of experience about legal matters. And then when she started getting into journalism, you know, now the hours are piling up. You can take that time that you think you wasted doing something else, and you're going to apply it to something that really appeals to you, and suddenly all of that experience enters into the practice. I did a lot of really bad jobs myself because as a writer I wanted a lot of world experience. I did construction work, etc. And all of those jobs taught me about people and about weird power situations and about the games bosses play in all different kinds of careers, all of which I used for the 48 Laws of Power. So you can be 35 and you're not going to go, oh, damn it, I can't do 10,000 hours. My life's screwed. No, you've already probably done 5,000 hours. Now you've got to find a way to apply it in a way that's appropriate and personal.
So that's a great way to look at it. It's almost like your past. Don't view it as, you know, you've messed up or whatever, but basically, how have you built these prior hours as a safety net that you could then use to build either mastery or close to mastery so that you can make that leap from the corporate job or the job that you're not really that excited about to something that you are more excited about? You're not everyone's a Mozart, but everyone can use the hours that they've built up to build some sort of safety net for themselves if they apply your techniques. What is the relationship between mastery and happiness? Because many of the examples you use, and in fact, you used the example earlier of Steve Jobs, but also let's throw in, you know, Mozart and Napoleon and so on. These, and Tesla, these people did not end up as happy people for, you know, by and large. So,
well, I would very much take issue with that. I mean, Steve Jobs, you know, he was a tempestuous person who was sort of upset, had a very obsessive personality. But I would say, you know, judging on the biography, the last 12 years of his life must have been in immensely satisfying. And there are people, you know, it depends on your definition of happiness. So, the book is called Mastery. It's not called Happiness. If I wanted to write a book on happiness, I would say, you know, go take drugs and hang out in Peru on a hilltop or something. That's not what my book is about. But I'll say that I am making the point that everybody has creative potential. Everybody, I believe. And I think the worst feeling in life comes from the sense as you get older that you didn't somehow tap that potential. You're not expressing what you think you could have expressed. And I think it really makes a lot of people very, very unhappy. So, you know, Mozart had a pretty great life when he finally left his father the last 10 years. He died young, but I would certainly claim he was pretty happy. I don't think a lot of these people who we see as very driven are necessarily unhappy. They do spend a lot of time with their work, and they are maybe obsessive, but that kind of attention to detail, to doing what you love, brings a sense of satisfaction that comes that maybe isn't the same satisfaction that you might get from an immediate rush of going to a party. It's a different kind of happiness. It's something a little more like a fulfillment. And I believe that mastery is the path towards that. So, and I have a quote in there from Da Vinci, which I love, which is basically just as a day when you've worked hard brings a blessed sleep, a life in which you've fulfilled what you're doing brings a blessed death. I'm quoting it horribly, but the idea is if you felt like you realized your potential, you almost feel like you can die a happy person, sort of thing.
I have to say, Airbnb has changed my life. I just love staying in Airbnbs. Like in about a month, I'm going to Cocoa Beach, which is right next to Cape Canaveral. I'm going to watch some rocket launches. I'm going to, of course, be staying in a very nice Airbnb on the beach. And it's just such a great experience. Like, the whole world is available to us now because of Airbnb. But whenever I'm at an Airbnb, I always realize, you know, the home that I left to come to this Airbnb, I could be making money on that right now by hosting and being an Airbnb myself. So, and I've known people, I had a friend who basically, you know, made a living from turning his home into an Airbnb. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, you do have an Airbnb there. And it can easily fit into your lifestyle, and it's a great way to earn some money. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. The famous Abraham Lincoln quote says, "Good things come to those who wait." I wonder, did he really say that? Jay, did he really say that? Can you look that up? Regardless of who said it, that's only part of the quote. The full quote is, "Good things come to those who wait, but only the things left by those who hustle." Well, if you're a business owner and want the best people on your team, the same applies. And listen, I've interviewed 1,500 people now and a lot of entrepreneurs. I can safely say the one thing consistent among all entrepreneurs and CEOs, the successful ones, is that it's all about the people you surround yourself. If you hire well, you're going to have a great business. And, you know, thankfully, ZipRecruiter puts the hustle in your hiring, so you find qualified candidates fast. This is so important, and I want you to try it. You could try it as a potential employer or employee. You could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter's smart technology finds top talent for your roles right away. Immediately after you post your job, if you're hiring, ZipRecruiter's matching technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I will tell you that I signed up on ZipRecruiter as a potential employee. You know, I just wanted to see how it works. And right away, it started matching me with really amazing potential employers. So give it a try at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Let ZipRecruiter give you the hiring hustle you need. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/James to try it for free. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
So I want to circle back to the one of your earlier books, which was on seduction, and this is also related to 48 Laws of Power, where essentially you give lots of not necessarily techniques, but different types of ways in which people can use, and I'll use the word manipulation, to get what they want. And what I'm wondering is, often in manipulation, the manipulator is viewed as having power, and the person he's manipulating is viewed as the weaker person. But in reality, it's most likely reversed. The reason you have to manipulate is because you are the weaker person. And if manipulation continues, don't you think some anxiety results from the person being manipulated that ultimately backfires on the manipulator?
Well, can you give me an example? It's also general. It's kind of hard to get my teeth into. It's kind of general that way.
Well, let's say I'm in a relationship with a girl, and I'm constantly pulling back or, you know, withholding affection in order to get her to do things I want. I'm not saying I do this. I'm just saying this is a type of seduction. You've mentioned it in your book, this type of seduction. Eventually, the other side of that is going to get sick and tired of it.
Well, then, if they do get sick and tired of it, you're a bad seducer. I mean, what is your goal? The goal is in the seduction game is to actually seduce the person, which means you either sleep with them or you have a relationship, depending on what you want. Well, at a certain point, you stop playing hot and cold because it's no longer effective, because as you say, they're going to see through it and they're going to get tired of it. So this is the problem people have. It's a book. I can't like be there in the room with you and talk to you as you read it. But the problem people have sometimes is you take things too literally. And it's also maybe a fault of my own and the kind of books that I write. It's not the reader's fault necessarily, but the whole thing of seduction is how outward you are. You're sensitive to the other person. You've got like these antennae that are invisible, and your feet, and you're hearing and listening and sensing that they're getting exasperated with you, that they're falling for you, that this is what's happening. And you gauge what you do depending on what you're picking up from them. So if you were an experienced seducer, if that's what you wanted to be, you're not just simply applying a strategy from the art of seduction. You're watching the other person and entering their spirit, which is one of the titles of the chapters, and kind of thinking what they might be thinking, and, okay, this is what's appropriate here. And then, you know, the word manipulation, I'm not going to run away from it. The books, both of those books you mentioned, many of the chapters or laws deal with what we would call manipulation, but when you're trying to start a relationship, let's say with a woman, you put effort into things. You dress maybe a little more nicely. You take her to nice places. You put an effort into it. And the woman sees this effort and is charmed and seduced by it, because it means you're thinking of the other person as an individual, not as just, you know, like a thousand other people you've met. That's what makes it so seductive. So is that manipulation? It's really kind of courtship. And a lot of women will end up complaining that men don't make any effort. So the opposite of seduction is like making no effort, just being yourself, just being kind of sloppy, just sort of taking her to Pizza Hut and watching a football game kind of thing. I don't deny that some of it's manipulation, but some of it is just the fact that you're showing that other person that you're playing this kind of courtship game, and it's supposed to be pleasurable. It's not supposed to be.
And Robert, just to be clear, it's definitely not your fault as an author. It's definitely my own idiosyncrasies as I read through this and relate to my own experiences. So trust that.
The way the books are written, sometimes they can be taken the wrong way, and everybody brings their own personal experience to it. So I've discovered that people who've been manipulated by somebody else, who've been the victim of someone that we would call sociopathic, they read my books in a much different way from others that haven't. So everybody brings their own world to it, and I guess that's a good thing. But It's. I try to make it clear in the preface and in the writing that you have to not just follow what I'm saying in a literal fashion. You know, you have to kind of be in the moment and be alive to what the other person is doing. And maybe what I'm writing about is completely inappropriate to your circumstances. So please don't do what I'm writing here, because it'll get you in trouble.
So now, Robert, you've put in the billion hours, gazillion hours to master writing. You're working on your next book. You've done a bunch of great books. What is, and sorry for the basic question, but basically, what's a day in the life like? Like, how do you continue your mastery every day of writing?
Well, it's not horribly glamorous. It's a lot of research, and the writing is actually maybe one third of the process. So I'll go for a year or more just researching and organizing my thoughts and the research material. And then I write. So my, it's different depending on where I am at. Right now, I'm just reading book after book after book and trying to organize my thoughts for this project on human nature that I mentioned. Then when I'm starting to write, it's I'll just sit and write for like 3 hours or 4 hours a day, and then I'm just like relaxing the rest of the time. And normally I do a lot of exercise and sports. It's how I deal with my stress. But unfortunately, with a broken foot, I'm not able to do that. So I'm kind of going crazy right now.
So you don't really, like, a lot of writers spend a lot of time building their so-called platform, whether it's their Facebook presence, their Twitter presence, their blog. You don't focus too much on that. You're very much focused on what is the next book going to be and how you can improve that.
Yeah, I'm a little, you know, I'm 54. I've got sort of habits. I'm not totally of the social media generation. I'm in, you know, Facebook, and I'm addicted to it like anybody. But I've never, if you talk about mastery, where I tell people to do what they love and to listen to your own voice, I listen to myself, and I get most excited by writing books. I do want to blog more because I actually sort of enjoy it. But I figured out what it is that I like the most, and it's actually creating something, usually a book, and not dissipating my time in 100 different platforms trying to build up an audience, etc. I just find it exhausting and depressing for me. So I like, but I'm fortunate that now I have an audience who've read my other books that I can do that. If I were a young writer just starting out, I wouldn't have that luxury. I'd have to do what you're talking about and, you know, spreading my name out all as many different places as I could online and creating a presence. And I'm kind of a dinosaur. There aren't going to be probably many of me type, my type left in the years to come. But I figure that if that's my strength is writing a book, you know, I might as well just do that and then go the way of the brontosaur.
Well, Robert, I have thoroughly enjoyed all of your books. I highly recommend Mastery. I'm really looking forward to the next book, and I'm really glad we had this chance to interview you today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
Cheers to a great day and this ice-cold Corona.
You know what would make this day even better? My grandma's carne asada.
Throw in some music.
We can watch the game. Or we could keep it simple.
Corona, la vida más fina. Get your Corona at ordercorona.com. Relax responsibly. Corona Extra Beer, imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.